3:14 a.m. The stranger pointed at the chalkboard and nodded solemnly, his lips quivering as if he might cry. He brought the board back down to rest in his arm again. Thomas was just about to speak when the man turned around and began to walk. Thomas didn't know what else to do but follow. The only other choice was to go deeper into the crank pits again. To each side, the cranks wailed and screamed and gnashed their teeth, arms reaching, reaching. They'd almost become background noise to Thomas. His focus was so riveted on the stranger in front of him. Thomas followed the man, passing through the gated tunnel, until he realized the awful sounds of the infected had faded. Finally, the man reached the gate leading back into the main tunnel, opened it, and stepped through. He waited for Thomas and the others to do the same, then closed it. The guards, still where they'd left them, watched the whole sequence of events transpire. Then one of them stepped forward, picked up the chain, and locked it back up. The sounds of the cranks were now distant echoes that could have been almost anything. Thomas and his friends stood packed closely together, an instinctive circle of protection. Albi and Minho were quieter than they'd ever been, and Teresa looked as shaken as Thomas felt. He couldn't take his eyes off the man with the weird sign, "Wicked is good." As Thomas pondered it, the man walked closer to his little group until he stood only a couple of feet from them. He took a second to gaze into the eyes of each of them in turn. Then he spoke for the first time.
"You're probably wondering who I am," he said.
His voice was unsettling, too cheerful to fit the circumstances.
"As well you should. You've seen the burden that I must bear, the weight that I must carry around with me. 3 words, my friends. Only 3 words. But I hope tonight has taught you that they are the most important 3 words in the world."
"Who are you?"
Albi asked, the question they were all thinking, certainly Thomas was.
"Do you work here?"
The man nodded.
"My name is John Michael. I..."
He paused to cough, pressing his hand to his chest.
"I was so essential to this organization. Once upon a time, it was me. It was I who gathered the survivors. The leaders gathered them here. I had the idea, my friends. I had the idea."
The last word came out in a shout, spit flying from his mouth. Thomas took a step backward, the others moving right with him.
"But then, you see," John Michael continued,
his eyes a little wilder, his demeanor a little more ruffled,
"then I caught the flare. The damned flare. I fought so hard to help our fellow humans."
His head drooped, and tears trickled down his cheeks.
"It's not fair that I should be the one to catch it. Soon I'll be living with..."
His gaze found its way past them, through them, and focused on the cages on the other side of the tunnel. The pits.
"But then..." "No," he said. "No. We won't allow such an undignified ending for me. Not for me. Not for the man who started the Post-Flares Coalition. Fought for its survival. Preached its importance. Would you throw someone like that into those pits? I ask you now. Would you?"
The man was becoming hysterical, staring straight at Thomas.
"Would you?"
Thomas shook his head adamantly, finding himself more afraid now than he had been all day. John Michael moved a half step closer to the group, a shuffle that was slightly off balance. His whole face glistened with tears.
"I'm not here to ask you any favors," he said. "I'm here to tell you there's no choice in the matter. It's your obligation to help people like me. Help future people like me. Do you understand?"
He emphasized the last sentence with a heart-wrenching sadness. The guards nearby did nothing, just stood like they'd been carved from wax. The shadows made it impossible to see their eyes.
"We understand,"
Teresa said, in a far steadier voice than Thomas would have been able to muster.
"We're sorry you're infected. Most of our parents got sick also, so we know what it's like."
The man's face suddenly transformed into a hideous, trembling red mask. His eyes bulged as he erupted into rage and began to spew a tirade of anger.
"You have no idea what it's like,"
he screamed, his voice cracking.
"How could you be trying to escape, running away from our chance to cure?"
The man was barely holding it together. Thomas didn't know how much more he could take of the meltdown. Minho stepped past Thomas and put himself directly in front of John Michael. Shockingly, the guards did nothing to interfere.
"We weren't going anywhere,"
Minho said, trying poorly to steady his voice.
"And it doesn't seem right to treat us like this." "Who do you think you—"
In mid-sentence, the man sprang forward with arms outstretched, reaching for Minho's throat. He caught him before Minho could move, both hands clasping the boy's neck as they fell to the ground. John Michael quickly scrambled on top of him, then put all his weight on Minho's throat, pressing him down. Minho kicked, arched his back, tore at the man's hands, all the while making a strangled, choking sound. Thomas had started moving to help, even though he had no idea what to do, but Albie knocked him out of the way and dove, crashing shoulder first into John Michael, knocking him off Minho, who sat up, heaving for breath. Thomas watched as Albie and John Michael rolled over a couple of times, each struggling to be on top. Then the man was straddling Albie just as he had Minho. Thomas was unable to move before Minho was on his feet, running to rescue his friend. Minho toppled John Michael, his momentum slamming the man to the ground. The guards broke out of their stupor and moved in to stop the sudden violence.
"All right," the female guard said, her voice calm. "That's enough. He's obviously not well."
Neither Minho nor Albie made one move that suggested they'd heard a word she said. The guard cocked her gun, then yelled in a much louder voice,
"Stop! Everyone!"
Thomas and Teresa managed to grab their friends around the chest and drag them away from the fallen man. Soon they were all standing there, working to catch their breath, looking down at the grown man who now lay on the ground weak and childlike, bleeding from the nose with a swollen lip. Then, shocking everyone once again, even the guards by the looks of it, he pushed himself onto his knees and clasped his hands together, held them out in front of his chest, fingers intertwined so tightly they shone white.
"Please,"
he said in a trembling voice.
"Please don't judge me. Please save me. If not me, those who come after. Please, I'm begging you. Please, please, please."
His every word was a whimper now, tears streaming from his face as if a faucet flowed behind his eyes. His shoulders shook, his arms and hands shook, his chest lurched with heavy sobs.
"Please, please save us. Please find us a cure."
Almost a whisper now. His eyes slowly closed. He slumped back to sit on his haunches.
"Please, please, please, please."
Each word came out between sobs, tremors quaking his body. Then, out of the darkness, Randall appeared, as if he'd been watching the whole thing from deep in the shadows. He walked forward, not saying a word until he stood directly over John Michael.
"This is what the world has come to," Randall said. "Unless you're immune, of course, and until we have a cure. Otherwise, there are two choices. Become one of those things you saw in the cages, or end it all before you reach the dawn. End your life, which this good man has asked me to do when the time seems right. I hope you can appreciate the effort it must have taken him to put together a few coherent sentences tonight."
He jerked his head at the guards.
"Take them back in. I think our old friend has reached his end date.
Randall pulled a gun out of his waistband and cocked it.
What are you going to do?
Thomas asked. Randall didn't reply, which was answer enough. Chapter 19 224.10.20 4:01 a.m. No one spoke. Not a word. They walked into the wicked complex and got checked in. Thomas and his friends remained stone silent. The two guards accompanied them to an elevator, and they rode it up several floors, then walked down a few halls. Eventually, they got to another elevator and took that up as well. Minho and Albi were escorted off the elevator first by the male guard. They exited the car with barely more than a nod of goodbye each, their eyes filled with sadness. Thomas and Teresa nodded back and waited quietly for the doors to close. Thomas rode the remaining floors consumed with his own thoughts. Finally, after what seemed like an endlessly long journey, Thomas and Teresa stood in front of the doors to their rooms, the female guard next to them.
"Here we are," she said,
the first words spoken since the tunnel, and they were light-hearted enough to anger Thomas.
"How could he do that?"
he said, cringing at how loud his voice sounded in the confines of the hallway.
"Just shoot a man in the back of the head!"
"And slap a kid who's barely 5 years old," he wanted to add, but didn't. The woman sighed, out of some deep frustration that seemed too complicated to understand.
"Mr. Michael himself, the man who made it possible for all of us to be here today, asked him to."
She opened Thomas's door.
"Come on now, bedtime. It might be a while before you and your friends can have another get-together, okay? Now get some shut-eye."
"How long?"
Thomas asked, surprised by that sudden announcement. In all that had happened, it hadn't occurred to him that he might not see his friends again any time soon.
"Couple years, they tell me,"
was her response.
"There's plenty of work to do, and everyone needs a full night's sleep. Just no more parties for the time being. It's for your own safety."
She turned away and left in a hurry. Thomas went into his room and closed the door, then leaned back against it, staring at the dull interior in which he'd lived since coming to Wicked. Despite all the horrors of the night, the guard's parting had been the toughest to bear.
"Couple years," the woman had said.
Then his earlier worry came back to hit him. What if they took away his meetings with Teresa? Or the job that had been dangled in front of them, building the maze? Ms. McVoy had said Wicked could use all the help available to them. Surely tonight didn't change that. He went to his bed and lay down, but he couldn't sleep. His clock told him it would soon be time for breakfast, and his mind was churning with all he'd seen that night. He closed his eyes and thought through all the goods and evils of this place they called Wicked. Thought of the cranks he'd been forced so close to only hours earlier. Their empty eyes, their torn clothes, their hollow cries of misery. They were human, but at the same time, the furthest thing from it. He thought of John Michael and the pitiful end to his life. He thought of the flare. The stupid flare. And Wicked wanted to find a cure for it. Wanted him to help them. Shouldn't he want to? His head throbbed by the time the knock came for breakfast. It was Dr. Page. Thomas asked her if she knew about the night's events. She only smiled, a very sad smile. Chapter 20 225.5.11 6:13 p.m. A few months later, Thomas had one of the worst days ever. It started with more medical tests than he'd had in a while. Blood taken, of course, but plasma also, followed by a full 45 minutes on the treadmill with what seemed like hundreds of sensors attached to his body.
Throughout the whole experience, his stomach hurt. It felt like he was being stabbed there with knives, and it only got worse as the day wore on. A headache joined in the fun shortly after and forced him to excuse himself from Mr. Glanville's class early. He didn't appreciate the disapproving glance that earned him. Then Miss Denton had sent him a note saying she'd been sorry to see him miss his session, the underlying message clear. Ever since the supposed escape attempt, his teachers and the staff members had seemed a little more distant. Even Dr. Page, who'd always been so nice to him, her smile didn't feel as genuine. And her eyes always had something behind them, like she knew a thousand things that he didn't, and that part of her wanted to share. But Thomas would have gladly accepted stomach cramps and a splitting headache every day if he could only see his friends again. His chest felt tight every time he thought of their names. How much fun he'd had on those precious few nights together, when the loneliness of being a subject of wicked had receded, just for a while. Even the meetings with Teresa had stopped lately, really worrying him that the job inside the cavern was off also. The days when they'd had basement get-togethers were long, long, long past. Surely some cosmic catastrophe had forever shifted the normal passing of time, stretching it out. Thomas lay in his bed that night, his uneaten dinner sitting on the desk. He'd barely had a bite for hours, and his stomach had made sure to leave nothing inside. He was empty in every way. He was also exhausted, yet unable to fall asleep. Instead, he closed his eyes, listened to himself breathe. Something buzzed in his head. He sat up, looking around the room. He'd heard, or more like, felt, a buzz somewhere deep in the pounding ache within his skull that had been plaguing him all day. He shook his head, pressed his fingers against his temples. He stood up to call Dr. Page, to ask for something to knock him out for the night, when the buzz came back, this time stronger. He fell to the bed, rolled into a ball, and held his hands over both sides of his head. The buzz didn't hurt, really. It was just so strange, so foreign. What ridiculous test had Wicked come up with now? Buzz. 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 Louder and stronger each time. It felt like an invasion of his body. It scared him, made him think of cranks, going crazy, seeing and hearing things that weren't there. Maybe they lied to us, he thought. Maybe we're not immune. They'd said Newt wasn't. Could it be possible? Buzz. He rolled onto his back and stared at the ceiling, his hands still glued to the sides of his head, as if that could do anything to help. Dr. Page. He had to call Dr. Page. Thomas. This time, it was a voice. But at the same time, not a voice. A vibration. A rattling of his mind. A disturbance that felt like the buzzing had formed into a solid word. He slowly stood up, hands out for balance. Thomas, this is Teresa. He was going crazy. He was actually going crazy. It was the oldest and most common symptom, hearing voices in your head. He said aloud. Is this working? Is this working? The last word landed between his eyes like a thunderbolt. The pain knocked his legs out from under him, and he collapsed onto the floor. Never had the world felt so fluid beneath him, as if nothing solid existed, no form, no substance. Teresa? He asked aloud, disoriented. Teresa? No answer. Of course there was no answer. He'd gone crazy. He had the flare. He'd be a crank soon. His life was over.
Listen to me,
the voice came again, the series of words like a horse galloping in his mind.
If you can hear me, pound on your door. I'll be able to hear it.
Thomas pulled himself to his knees. He supposed he had nothing left to lose, so, the world swimming around him, he crawled across his room toward the door.
As strange as it sounded, the odd voice in his head was more like a presence, and he didn't know how to explain it, but it felt like Teresa. He made it to the door, tall as a mountain as he knelt before it.
"Thomas?" came the voice. "Thomas, please. Please tell me this works. It's taken me months to figure it out. If you can hear me, pound on your door."
She shouted the last part, another series of thunks in his skull that hurt like an ice pick. He steadied himself, raised his hands to rest on the door's surface, then squeezed his fingers into fists.
"What you're about to do," he told himself, "just might be the last nail in your flare coffin. If you're wrong, you'll know you're truly crazy."
The voice again. Teresa.
"Thomas? Thomas! Make the sound!"
He did it. He reared back with both fists, then banged them against the door, beat it like it might be the last barrier to his freedom. In for a penny, in for a pound. He'd read that in one of those classics they'd given him. For a solid 10 seconds, he threw his fists forward onto the hard surface until his knuckles ached and the pain shimmied up both arms. Then he collapsed to the floor again, struggling to catch his breath. He heard shouts down the hall, footsteps, someone coming to check on him. But before anyone arrived, one last sentence surfaced in his mind.
"Good, got it," Teresa said,
a sense of excitement somehow attached to her voice.
"I'll teach you how to do this later."
And then she was gone. Not just her voice, but her presence as well.
Gone.
Like an extinguished light. The door swung open and Dr. Page stood there.
"What in the world's come over you?"
she asked. Chapter 21 225.5.12 7:44 p.m. The next day passed in agony for Thomas. He could barely wait to see Teresa in the flesh for just 10 minutes, 5 minutes. All he needed was enough time to look her in the eyes and ask her, "Was it you?" He'd know in an instant, and he needed the confirmation desperately. As he ate breakfast, had a checkup, went from class to class, the same question ran through his mind.
"Am I crazy?"
He'd even tried to ask Dr. Page about his fears when she'd first retrieved him that morning.
"So how do you know I'm immune?"
he'd asked her, watching her expression carefully as she answered.
"It's fairly straightforward,"
she replied easily, walking next to him down the hallway.
"There are very specific markers in your blood makeup, DNA, and cerebrospinal fluid that are consistent among all those who are immune. The markers are missing in those who are not immune. It took a lot of study to get to that point, but it's solid now."
He considered that. It certainly sounded like she was telling the truth.
"Also," she added, "it's doubly confirmed in someone like you and the other immune subjects we've gathered."
"What do you mean?"
"Well, we can verify with brain scans that the virus itself has taken hold inside you, that it's made a home for itself. And yet it has no effect whatsoever on your physical matter, your mental capacity, your bodily functions. And you've had the virus for years, with no change. Unless it's some sort of massive mutation of the virus, which our studies have shown no evidence of, then we can say with almost certain scientific and medical accuracy that you're immune."
He nodded, fairly confident she was being honest with him.
"So if I started showing symptoms of the flare, say, tomorrow, how shocked would you be? On a scale of 1 to 10.
She looked over at him.
10, Thomas. I'd be beyond shocked. As shocked as if you sprouted a third ear. What's all this about?"
He stopped in the hallway and faced her.
"Dr. Page, do you swear on your own life that I'm immune? That this isn't some kind of, I don't know, some kind of test? I know you guys are really fond of tests. How do I know I'm not like Newt? Not immune?"
Dr. Page gave him that smile. That smile that always made him feel a little better.
"I swear to you, Thomas.
I swear on the graves of the countless loved ones who have died. I swear that I've never lied to you. You're as immune as science and medicine can possibly conclude. And if there was any chance of anything endangering your life, I wouldn't allow it." He stared into her eyes. He found that he truly believed her, and that made him feel warm inside, as if a little piece of the wall he'd built up to protect himself had crumbled away.
"Why are you asking me these things?" she asked. "What's wrong?"
He almost told her the truth, that he'd heard a voice inside his head. He almost told her.
"Dreams," he answered. "I keep having these dreams that I go crazy. And the worst part is that I'm not even aware it's happened. Do any of the cranks actually know that they've lost their minds? How do we know we're not cranks?"
She nodded, as if that was a completely valid question.
"That sounds like something for your philosophy class. Next month, I believe."
She'd started walking again, and the conversation was over. Thomas sat in his room thinking over the morning's conversation with Dr. Page once more. Ever since the wake-up, he'd hoped that Teresa would talk to him again, while at the same time hoping she didn't. Maybe that in itself was another sign he'd lost his mind to infection. But the more he thought about it, the more he believed Dr. Page. She was either sincere or the best actress the world had ever known. Finally, Thomas was too tired to worry anymore, and he turned off his lights and hoped sleep would beat the odds and take him away. It was only an hour or so later, just when he'd begun dozing off, that Teresa spoke to him again.
"Thomas, are you there?"
It didn't shock him like it had the first time. This time, there was no buzzing. And on some level, he'd been expecting it, so it wasn't as disorienting. Even so, any trace of sleep vanished at her words, and he sat up, got out of bed, went over to sit at his desk.
"I'm here,"
he said aloud, once again feeling like an idiot for doing so. He had absolutely no idea how to respond to her with his mind.
"I can feel you trying to answer," she said. "The implants they put in our heads, I've been trying to figure out what's felt different since they did it, and as soon as I pressed through to make contact to you, it all clicked."
Thomas sat there, nodding to himself like a dummy. It didn't escape him how strange it was that it already felt somewhat normal to have a girl speaking to him telepathically.
"You have to focus," Teresa continued. "Probe your mind to find the foreign object, then focus on it. Press through it. You won't know what I'm talking about until you try."
Her words came in a rush now, no longer painful, but still disorienting.
"Okay,"
he said, knowing she couldn't hear him.
"Try it as you go to sleep tonight," she said. "I'll contact you every night until I hear back. Don't give up."
He could sense the weight she put on the last three words, the importance of what she was telling him.
"Okay,"
he said again. Then, confident he'd heard the last from her, he lay back down in bed and started tinkering with his own mind. For several days and nights he worked at it, and it was the most frustrating thing he'd ever done. All he had at his disposal were mental tools, nothing physical. Maybe if he could take a scalpel and open his own head up, it would have been easier to pick and probe until he found something like a huge old-school light switch that needed flipping. But no. He had to close his eyes and search with fingers that only existed in his own imagination. Once he let go of thinking about things in such a black-and-white manner, he was able to start seeing his own thoughts and conscience as things he could mentally manipulate. That was when he started making progress. He let his thoughts disappear and focused on nothing, until suddenly it was clear. There was an area that didn't seem to belong. And then he pressed on, working against it and thinking the one word he wanted to send.
Teresa.
Then finally, one night, he felt more than heard Teresa receive his message. It was as if he'd poked her with a cattle prod. He whooped,
lying in bed, knowing he was close, hoping he hadn't hurt her too much.
"Keep going," she'd said in his mind. "You're almost there, and next time, try not to electrocute my eyeballs."
He had no idea what that meant, but he smiled all the same, and kept trying. Chapter 22 226.3.9 8:12 p.m.
"I can't fall asleep," Thomas said to Teresa.
Almost a year had passed since he'd finally mastered the implanted telepathy.
"Maybe that's because it's barely past 8 o'clock, she responded. "And last time I checked, you're not a 70-year-old man. Hey, I like my beauty sleep. How do you think I maintain this fine specimen of a face?"
She snorted. It felt similar to those buzzes she'd communicated when she'd first spoken to him this way.
"Yeah, I swoon every time I see you."
"Which is never."
"Exactly."
There was a long pause, but the great thing about their trick was that even when neither one of them spoke, whatever connection they had in their minds made them feel the other's presence. After months and months of practice, he could almost believe that she was in the room with him. He craved it every night, and missed it whenever he was idle during the day. Whenever he happened to have a spare minute.
"How's the plan coming along?"
he finally asked, even though he knew it would annoy her. He almost enjoyed asking her the same thing every night for weeks, just because it annoyed her. But this time, he didn't get the usual irritated response.
"I think I figured it out," she said.
Thomas sat up.
"Really?" "No, not really. Go get your beauty sleep."
Thomas just rolled his eyes. He could sense that Teresa got his response. Even though Thomas's and Teresa's doors had remained unlocked, Thomas knew they were being observed, and that they were still feeling the aftermath of their trip outside. They'd tried to sneak out to meet their friends a few times since that night, but the moment they left their rooms, a guard would appear and kindly but firmly tell them to please go back. It's for your own good. Always everything was for their own good. And even though they didn't have the best gourmet chef in the world, food was one of the few things Thomas looked forward to in life. At the very least, Wicked considered quantity more important than quality, and that was just fine with Thomas. Growing like crazy, he was always hungry. But maybe he'd have more than food to get excited about very soon. Teresa learning more and more about computers and information systems, their studies track had been diverging lately, becoming more specialized, had been told that the physical construction of the mazes was almost complete, and Wicked would soon be ready for their help with things like programming the false sky and testing the optical illusion systems. Eris and Rachel, two people they still hadn't met, were also on the work schedule. Teresa had a knack for the computer system side of things, so that was where most of her training took place. And she was much, much better at it than they knew. Much better.
"We can do it," she said one morning, waking him up from a dead sleep.
Thomas rubbed his eyes groggily, not bothering to ask her what she meant. She'd tell him soon enough. She always did.
"I know the security camera system like the back of my hand now. I've queued up all the recordings we need to loop for the night, then backtracked and erased my movements. It's all set up."
Thomas was totally awake in an instant. His excitement made him almost laugh with happiness. But he was also scared to death. Their punishment the last time they were caught out of their rooms, the crank pits, still haunted him. But after so long without his friends, he was desperate to try anything.
"Are you sure we won't get caught?" he asked. "Very sure. I know where the guards are stationed. Everyone else will be asleep, and the lighting at night is so low that it will be really hard for someone to notice the loops. We'll be okay."
100% okay?"
99.
"Good enough for me.
Then we go exploring tonight." "Open your door in 20 seconds, she told him just after midnight. "I want to be in your room as fast as possible.
Thomas did exactly as she instructed, and less than half a minute later she joined him inside his quarters. It was the first time someone other than a wicked employee had gone past his door. He surprised her, and himself, by pulling her into a fierce hug, squeezing her like she'd disappear if he let go. Thankfully, she returned the effort just as strongly.
"Man, it's good to see you," he said, still speaking with his mind. He'd grown so used to it.
She responded by hugging him even tighter. Eventually, sadly, they let go. He sat on the bed and she sat at his desk.
"Let's give it a few minutes. Make sure the first loop is working," Teresa said to him, smiling with anticipation.
He'd never seen her so full of energy and excitement.
"What will we do if they catch us?"
Thomas asked, relieved to use his real voice with her again.
"This might set us back. I mean, we'll be working more on the mazes and stuff. Are we sure we want to risk it? What if they take it away?"
He didn't know why he bothered. Teresa answered only by rolling her eyes. They were going to explore, and that was that. After a few minutes of silence, Teresa spoke into his mind.
"Let's go," she said. "And let's stick to the telepathy just in case. The video will work great, but who knows who might hear us if we're talking out loud. We can only speak if we run into our friends, and then only whisper. Sound good?"
"Sounds like a plan," he replied. They opened the door to his room, looked both ways, then went for it.
"I've got it all timed," Teresa said. "When I say we have to leave for the next area, no arguing, or else someone is going to catch us when the loops run out."
Thomas merely nodded, and then they were running, his chest on fire. A few turns, a trip through the elevator, a few more turns, always pausing to peek around corners, make sure no one was wandering the halls. Their first stop was the sector of Group B. The goal was to meet Eris and Rachel. They had placards on their doors just like Thomas's and Teresa's. But when Teresa knocked on Eris's door, there was no answer. They tried Rachel's. Again, no response. Teresa spoke with their special ability.
"These guys are either heavy sleepers, extremely obedient, or they're out breaking the rules just like us."
Thomas nodded.
"Oh, well. Should we go say hi to Newt and them now?"
Teresa nodded and he took the lead, winding through the halls and stairways, glad for the dimmed lighting. Teresa communicated the pattern she'd set up with the camera loops to figure out the best route, and where to stop and wait. Finally, they turned the last corner before the Group A sector and stopped dead. Thomas sucked in a breath. There was a young boy in the hall. He had to be only 7 or 8 years old, and was a little on the pudgy side. He sat with his back against the wall, arms wrapped around his knees, tears covered his face. When he saw Thomas and Teresa, he went as pale as the moon and jumped to his feet.
"I'm sorry," he stuttered. "Please don't tell on me."
Thomas slowly crossed the distance between them and put a hand on the boy's shoulder, trying to reassure him.
"It's okay, man. We're just like you. Nothing to worry about." "What's your name?" Teresa asked.
Their whole plan was now in jeopardy, but the kid seemed so young, so innocent, so scared. The boy burst into another round of tears, then answered through one of his sobs.
"They're making me call myself Charles."
Thomas shook his head.
"Well, that's lame. We're going to call you Chuck."
Chapter 23 226.5.17 2:42 a.m.
"Are you staying in the barracks?" Thomas asked the boy. "Barracks? No. I've got my own room. At least for now."
Teresa looked at Thomas, and he knew what she was thinking, even without the telepathy. Why did this kid have his own room?
"Is it close?" Teresa asked the boy. "Maybe we can go in there to talk."
She glanced at Thomas again.
"We have other friends we could get. Would that help you feel a little better?"
Chuck nodded, relief filling his eyes. He probably thought he'd never have friends again. He turned around and led them to his room, and Thomas got comfortable in the chair by the desk while Teresa went to get Newt, Albie, and Minho. According to her setup of camera loops, they had a few hours before they needed to be back in their own rooms. Chuck lay on his bed, and Thomas pulled the desk chair to within a couple of feet.
"How long since they brought you in here?" Thomas asked.
"A couple of weeks. I don't know if my parents knew about it. I don't even know if they had the flare."
He started sobbing again, and Thomas didn't know what to do.
"It's okay," he said,
a pitiful attempt to make the kid feel better.
"Teresa and I have been here for years. You get kind of used to it. I know they can be jerks when it comes to renaming you, but after that it gets a lot better, as long as you basically do what they tell you to do."
Chuck didn't seem too appeased. A few more tears trickled down his face.
"What are they going to do to me?"
the boy asked, sniffing back more tears.
"So far they've pricked me with needles about a million times."
"Well, yeah. They'll be doing that to you for years. You get used to it."
"Just be glad you don't know about the implants yet," he refrained from saying.
"But most of what happens is like school. You'll go to classes, learn lots of stuff. It's fun, actually. Plus, you'll make new friends."
He wondered again why Chuck was in a single room, not in the barracks with the other boys in Group A. Chuck sat up on the edge of his bed, curious about what Thomas could tell him, and started unloading questions.
"Why do you think we're immune? Did your parents get the flare? Did you see them go crazy? Did you have any brothers or sisters?"
A few other inquiries flew out, Chuck not allowing Thomas a single second to attempt an answer to any of them. Luckily, Thomas was saved when the door opened. In marched Albi, then Min-ho, then Newt, then Teresa.
"What's up, Tommy?"
Newt exclaimed, his face filled with genuine happiness at the pleasant surprise that had been sprung on him. Thomas couldn't remember exactly how long it had been since the last time he'd seen Newt.
"You look bloody fantastic for 3 in the morning.
"Who's the new kid?"
Min-ho asked. Albi, a bit more thoughtful, went up to Chuck and shook his hand.
"What's your name?"
"Mine's Albi."
"I'm Chuck. I just got here."
Albi nodded.
"Cool, man. They'll probably move you into the barracks with us soon. It'll be fun, don't worry. This place is all fun and games."
Thomas had never heard such kind lies. The next couple of hours passed with light conversation, lots of laughs, and dreams of the future that no one actually expected to happen. But for a little while, anyway, it was nice to pretend, to relax, to let themselves think they had a future, and could do whatever they wished with it. It was the best night Thomas could remember having since he'd first met his friends. He laughed even more than he remembered laughing that first night. He also felt at peace as they talked, often over each other, many times needing to repeat what they'd said because of being drowned out. Chuck's demeanor had gone from blurry eyes and a tear-streaked face to the joy and wonder of a kid at a birthday party. And that made Thomas feel good. This place, he thought. Wicked. There were a million ways it could be worse. He'd been spared having to watch his mom succumb to the flare, been spared from the harsh realities of the outside world, spared a terrifying death at the hands of a crank, spared a lot of sorrow and horror in his life. And what was the price? Boredom? A few tests? Dealing with a bunch of strange grown-ups who didn't always know how to handle children? And here Thomas was, sitting with a group of friends, joking, laughing, feeling good. And hey, a cure. Why not?
"Tommy."
It was Newt, breaking him out of his thoughts.
"I can see your wheels spinning up there."
He tapped the side of his head.
"Care to share?"
Thomas shrugged.
"I don't know. I keep thinking that Wicked did something terrible by stealing us from our families."
"Yeah," Albi said, though the half-grin on his face showed that he'd probably considered what Thomas was about to say next.
"But I'm not so sure that's true."
"So Wicked isn't bad?"
Chuck asked, perking up. There was so much hope in the boy's voice that it hurt Thomas a little. Thomas looked up at his group of friends, then looked at Chuck.
"A man once gave us a message that we'll never forget," he said. "Wicked is good. I think our lives might have a lot more purpose than we could ever know. I think we need to remember to look at the big picture.
That's some deep thinking, Teresa said telepathically. Makes you look cute.
Don't, not in front of the others.
He did his best to shout it at her, and he felt a prick of pride when he saw her flinch a little.
Thomas, dude,
Albie said.
There you go again, drifting off, staring into space like an idiot.
He had too much on his mind to try to put it all into words.
I just think we need to keep things in perspective. We're safe, we're warm, we're fed. We're protected from the weather and the cranks.
You make it sound like a bloody holiday,
Newt murmured.
It could be a lot worse, Thomas countered.
Not to mention the small fact that we're trying to help save the entire human race.
And that means you, Newt,
Albie added.
I don't want to watch you go all crank on me someday.
That sobered Newt right up. Even Teresa looked sad. Thomas had ruined it for everybody, even though he'd tried to be positive about their ordeal. Thomas glanced over at Min-ho, who'd been quiet for a while. He sat in the corner, his back against the wall, staring at the floor. He caught Thomas's eye and stood up.
"Make up all the fantasies about Wicked you want," he said. "Tell yourselves this is all a good cause, that they treat us well. I'm not buying it, though. It looks like I'm the only one still working on..."
Min-ho stopped mid-sentence and shook his head.
"I'm heading back to my room now. Later."
Min-ho was at the door and had it opened before anyone had time to recover. Albie found his voice before Min-ho disappeared.
"What are you talking about?"
Albie asked. Min-ho had his back to them, but he didn't even turn his head to answer.
"We used to talk about escaping before Thomas and Teresa came around," he said. "Well, I never stopped thinking about it, or planning for it. We should be here by our own choice, not by theirs, not treated like prisoners. I hope you guys'll come with me, when I'm ready."
Then he left, shutting the door behind him. Chapter 24 2:26.11.12 11:21 a.m. That was the last Thomas heard of Min-ho's great escape plan for 6 months. During that time, life was fascinating and fun. About once a week, Teresa worked her magic on the security camera loops, and they had a get-together in one of their rooms, or, more frequently, in the old maintenance room, deep below everything else. And it was always the same group. Albie, Min-ho, Newt, Thomas, Teresa. And sometimes little Chuck. He'd become their favorite. He was goofy, innocent, and gullible, and he took all their jokes in stride. He'd become like the little brother they'd lost, or, in Thomas's case, never had in the first place. Sometimes they smuggled in food and ate as they talked and laughed. After a few months of these nights, they'd mostly forgotten that fear they'd all had. The fear of Randall or Ramirez walking in at any moment. Of being sent back to the crank pits. Maybe this time there would be no fences to protect them. They forgot to be scared, and they felt safe. It was the best time of their lives.
"Okay," Teresa said in Thomas's mind. "Let me know when you see a red dot flash in the exact center of the ceiling."
"Roger that," he replied.
"Would you please stop saying that?"
Thomas held back a laugh. He stood surrounded by mountainous walls of stone that the heavy construction crews had built around skeletons of steel and fiberglass. At least half of the maze was complete, and it was starting to look spectacular. As he waited for Teresa's signal, he tried to imagine what the place would be like when it was finished, especially with the optical illusion technology in place. The technology would work alongside certain powerful suggestions provided by the subject's brain implants to make everything seem 3 times as tall, as wide, as long. And it was big already. Even though he and Teresa were helping with the creation of it all, their wicked overseers didn't share a lot of information about how exactly things would work once they opened the maze for business. He'd heard the word variables thrown around a lot, and he knew that the Sykes had spent years planning for these kill zone experiments.
He also knew there'd be some harshness. Thomas and Teresa were far from stupid, and they took every opportunity to find out more about the project they were working on. Once they'd come across a page listing preliminary variables, and a couple of things really stood out. Words like forced pain, and attack, and elimination of comforts. Those were mixed in with a bunch of scientific writing that didn't always make sense. But things were moving forward, if a little behind schedule. One day, maybe with just a few years of intense research and testing, Wicked would have its cure. And Thomas could always say he'd been a big part of it. He'd started telling himself this a lot. It was easy, and it made him feel better.
"Have you seriously not seen it yet?"
Teresa asked, sending a jolt of annoyance along with her words.
"Oh, sorry."
He was constantly losing himself in his thoughts lately.
"Yeah, yeah, there's a bright red dot, practically right above me." "Practically, or is it exactly in the right spot?"
Well,
it might be about 10 feet off, actually.
And, maybe a dozen or so are blurry and scattered. Sorry." It had to be one. Just one red dot, centered.
"Tom, we have to get this right before we can move on to another project. And I'm sick of this one. Tell me about it. My neck is killing me from looking up at all these mistakes."
She ignored him, having learned that that was the best way to get back at him for lame, sarcastic comments.
"Let me try again," she said.
They'd been at this for at least 2 weeks, trying and failing, trying and failing. Ms. McVoy had assigned them to the Sky Project, and their job was to program and fine-tune the systems to look like a normal sky to those below. Blue sky, night sky, the stars, the passing of the sun, everything. Thomas couldn't wait to see the result in all its glory. But first, he and Teresa had to get the balance right. Thomas suspected that Wicked knew they'd been communicating telepathically before they were officially told about it and taught how to use it. But no one said anything. He supposed Wicked could only benefit from their having mastered the technique, as the instant communication made them ideal for these types of projects, which appeared to be plentiful. Teresa was projecting a red dot from 1,000 different sources around the vast interior surface of the maze cavern, and until Thomas saw it as a single dot in a specific location, the technicians couldn't move forward with the projecting software. A half hour later, Teresa tried it again. This time, there were only 6 red dots, and the largest one was only 4 or 5 feet from center. They were very close.
"Let's wrap this up tomorrow," Thomas said after the test. "I gotta get a nap in before our rendezvous tonight with the fellas." "Deal."
Only one word, not spoken aloud, but she sounded exhausted all the same. They gathered in the maintenance room around 1 o'clock in the morning. Thomas had taken a good 3 or 4 hour nap, but still felt groggy when Minho passed around some awful liquid concoction that made Thomas's throat burn. Albie had a giant bag of potato chips, stolen from where, no one had any idea, and no one bothered to ask. The salty, crunchy goodness of every bite was especially powerful at such a late hour. Chuck had way more than his fair share.
"I've got a new guy coming tonight," Minho said, not 10 minutes after they'd settled in to eat their junk food.
Thomas's hand froze halfway to his mouth, holding a tantalizing chip waiting to be chomped. Teresa leaned forward. Newt raised his eyebrows. Albie simply said,
"Come again?"
Chuck didn't pause for a second. He continued to eat as if a cure for the flare might depend on it. Minho, seeing how unexpected his pronouncement had been taken, stood up and waved an arm to say it was no big deal.
"Nothing to worry about, folks. He's a good enough guy."
He stopped talking, though his eyes showed he had a lot more to say.
"Good enough?"
Teresa repeated.
"That's the criteria now for trusting our secret to someone new?"
The confidence and swagger that had defined Minho just 20 seconds earlier suddenly vanished.
"His name is Galley, and he's, You remember that plan I told you about, to escape?
Thomas felt his heart sink a little at that. He'd assumed, hoped, that Minho's notion had died a quick and lasting death.
Yeah, we remember,
Albie said.
We also remember the crank pits, and the beds we have, and the food we get, and the walls that protect us from the insane asylum they call the world.
Your point?
Gally's going to help me, Minho replied, looking sheepishly around the room. He should be here any second.
With seemingly perfect timing, someone knocked on the door as soon as he'd finished his sentence. Chapter 25 2:26.11.13 1:34 a.m. Thomas felt sorry for Gally the second he walked into the room. Nothing really stood out about the kid. Black hair, tall and skinny, pale skin. He had some ugly teeth, but that wasn't so unusual. Thomas couldn't remember ever going to a dentist himself. Still, Gally seemed pathetic somehow. His eyes, maybe. If you looked into his eyes, you could tell that something had broken inside him a long time ago.
Everyone, meet Gally, Minho said. Gally, meet everyone. Some of you know him, or at least have seen him around. I'm sure we'll all get along peachy.
Good that, Newt said.
Gally gave everyone a nice enough nod, a sincere attempt at a smile. Thomas and the others did their best to return it. After a long, awkward silence, Albie asked exactly what Thomas was wondering.
So, how's Gally supposed to help with his idiotic plan to escape?
I'll let him tell you,
Minho replied, thumping the new boy on the back. Gally cleared his throat.
I work out on the grounds with a couple others. Mostly landscaping stuff. Cutting down weeds, shoveling snow when the odd storm hits, trying to get bushes and flowers to grow. But I also do electrical work, maintenance, whatever. The three of us work under a guy named Chase.
And this will help you how? Albie pressed, making it clear how he felt about an escape plan.
You going to push Minho to the woods in a wheelbarrow?
Newt snickered, then caught himself.
Sorry, he mumbled.
Gally, instead of getting offended, smiled right along.
If anyone gets to be pushed around in a wheelbarrow, it's going to be me. Minho owes me.
Why?
Teresa asked. Minho answered.
Because he's the only way this thing works.
Everyone looked to Gally for an explanation. Everyone except Chuck, who'd fallen asleep on the floor, a dirty mop as his pillow.
Chase isn't the smartest dude at Wicked, let's just say that.
Gally stared at the floor as he spoke. Thomas didn't know how to interpret that.
I've been setting up little things for weeks now, things that'll help someone get past the Wicked security measures. Truth is, Wicked relies on the threat of cranks and the state of the world to prevent us from trying anything. It's a lot harder to get into Wicked than to get out.
And what in the world do you plan to do once you're out in the great Alaskan wilderness? Teresa asked.
Rent a car? Go find a nice apartment in Juneau?
Man, you guys really like your sarcasm, Gally said. I mean, do you think I'm stupid? Just because I don't sneak out and have little parties with the cleaning supplies? Gally, chill,
Minho warned. Gally threw his arms up.
They're the ones who need to grow up.
Hey, Albie shouted. Don't come in here all high and mighty. We didn't invite you.
That's it. I'm out,
Gally said, as he walked toward the exit. Minho jumped in front of him, put a hand on his chest. Gally stopped. Minho looked around.
Come on, guys. Can you give me the benefit of the doubt here? Why do you think I've waited months to pull the trigger? Because I'm patient and not stupid. Gally's figured out a way to communicate with a cousin in Canada. He's close to the border. Gally used Chase's transponder codes. We'll have people waiting for us a few miles into the woods. They're already on standby.
Thomas couldn't believe what he was hearing. Minho really meant it. Despite all the things they had better off than the rest of the world, he wanted out.
Why?
Thomas asked. That one word got everyone's attention.
Just tell us why, Minho.
We know you're not stupid, and I'm sure Gally isn't either. But why would you guys want to leave?
Because we're prisoners, Minho answered.